This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekness starts in 3, 2, 1.
You come across a podcast. A podcast about critically loved movies and the three geeks that test them. Your fear heightens as you notice it's October, and what was Art House Legends becomes something darker, more sinister. You notice adult language and content and carefully guard the ears of the innocent. In the back of your mind, you know that spoilers are ahead and opt to watch the movie before journeying forward. You take one last breath of air before entering
the Art House of Horror.
Welcome to the podcast that's coming for you, Barbara and Bill and George and everybody else. This is the Movie Dude Eric, and along with me are...
Oh, hey, this is Kent. I'm back from my meeting with SNASA, or Secret NASA, where we were talking about radiation, but it's nothing to worry about. Nothing. Don't concern yourself with radiation in Venus at all.
Hey, this is Chris, and you can be the boss down there, but Art House of Horror is boss up here.
And in this episode, we're discussing Night of the Living Dead, starring Dwayne Jones, Judith O'Day, Carl Hardman, Marilyn Eastman, Keith Wayne, Judith Ridley, Kira Sean, and directed by George A. Romero. Gentlemen, we have come to the beginning of a genre that has lasted practically 50 years now and is still going strong on television. How familiar are you with this franchise?
the Romero branded franchise or the concept of zombie on screen?
Either.
Okay. Yeah, no, most of I wasn't allowed to watch horror movies when I was growing up, but I managed to get secondhand as these were coming. The sequels to this really kind of, a lot of them kind of hit in the '80s, and I would just hear secondhand about stuff. But always kind of surprised me. This movie itself wasn't really, it seemed like people had seen it, but they really were into more of the sequels than the original. Maybe it was just because it took so long coming out on just video time.
It's kind of difficult to get a movie from 1968 onto VHS.
Yeah.
Or Beta, for that matter.
It was odd. It's like, you know, why? It seemed like it's for this or something weird that nobody really talked about watching the original. So, even though it wasn't, well, we'll get into it later on. About other parts, but since I could have aired it on TV without problems.
But what about you, Chris? So what's your familiarity with Romero's zombie movies or zombie movies in general?
I'm fairly familiar with all of them, really. I've seen all the Romero stuff. I've seen the remakes. God, I've seen a lot of zombie movies, and
is this one of your favorite genres?
Maybe it used to be, but it's all so cliche now. It's all just the same. It just feels like a hamster running in the same wheel, you know.
I am going to say that I'm not the biggest fan of zombies. If anyone has been familiar with my criticisms of the genre for the last 10 years, you know that I was pretty much zombied out by the time The Walking Dead came out. And since then, it's one of those that I do enjoy certain aspects of the genre, but a lot of it is basically just the same old thing over and over and over again. That said, I came onto the Romero train probably like around the 2000, 2001. That was the first time that I saw Night of the Living Dead. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed the movie. I actually kind of did go in order from Night of the Living Dead to the sequels, or the, I don't know if they're really technically sequels or more just kind of spiritual sequels, which would be Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead and the other zombie movies of that nature. I will say, though, that more recently, within like the last 5 years, I actually did eventually come around to doing the Return series, which is also a spinoff of their own, but that would be for another day. And I will say Return of the Living Dead, well, that is just fucking awesome. I'm sorry, it is so much fun. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about Night of the Living Dead, which is the first of its the first of the zombie movies. But on top of that, it's also another first, which is the first of the independent super mega blockbuster, because this movie was done on an extremely low budget, and basically just it came out. It was done basically for about, I want to say, about $20,000 to $30,000. George A. Romero and just a bunch of his friends, and from what it sounds like, a whole lot of beer. got this movie off the ground. And from that particular point, it blew up. It hit the drive-in circuit and kind of went that particular route. And then, of course, as the horror genre became more prominent during the 70s specifically, this movie kind of found a home in the genre of fans' hearts. And of course, I believe it was 1982 is when Dawn of the Dead was made. At that particular point, you know, the zombie genre found its home, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
But at this particular point, let's go ahead and let's talk about George A. Romero. Now, unfortunately, George A. Romero had recently passed away. I believe he was, 77 at the time that he passed? Mm-hmm. Someone can correct me on that.
I'm looking it up.
But, you know, he tried his hardest to not just be known for zombie movies. He actually tried to make a name for himself outside of that. Unfortunately, though, when you created something as memorable as the current rendition of zombies, it's very difficult to get out of that. And I'm just kind of curious as to what is your familiarity with Romero's work, and what do you consider to be his greatest triumph?
See, I was only familiar with his, basically, his Living Dead series. I had no idea he did some other, like, other stuff. But, I mean, I've heard of Creepshow, but,
Well, he also did a lot of stuff with Stephen King. Stephen King kind of worked with him on several things, especially during the 70s. One of the ones that was most memorable for me was called Knight Riders, K-N-I-G-H-T, which was basically Hell's Angels going back to the time of King Arthur and becoming Knights of the Round Table. Ed Harris was actually a part of that movie, which, like I said, it was insane. It was goofy. It was schlocky. But it was also a lot of fun. It's kind of bad, won't lie, but it was kind of awesome in the badness. But yeah, he tried his hardest to kind of not be known specifically for zombies. But at the same time, though, this is a great legacy to have if you should have one, especially in the horror, when it comes to horror, right? Or do you think that perhaps he was, you know, that even though he kind of originated it, that he didn't really perfect it? I'm kind of curious as to what's your impressions of his impacts on the zombie genre after founding it.
Oh. Well, he did create a template that guys expanded on and, well, sometimes subtracted from, too. We'll talk, I'm sure we'll talk about the zombies themselves here, but,
We'll be talking about the evolution of zombies, because let's be honest here, the zombies in this particular movie they don't follow the same template as what we would now consider to be zombies. In fact, I will make I'll kind of tip my hand a little bit, but in a way, zombies in this movie feel more akin to old Frankenstein movies than what we consider to be zombie movies, with the exception of one sequence, which we'll definitely be talking about a little bit later. But right, I mean, the way that they kind of clamber, they use weapons,
right?
They are afraid of fire. All of these things feel, especially the way that they move, they feel like Frankenstein, like Boris Karloff. And I believe that can you remember when we were talking about Frankenstein last year? Kind of how don't they feel like they kind of follow that mold more than the current ideal zombie?
It's that might have been the stage direction boost. Karloff, okay. Is that
I wouldn't be surprised, especially that especially the lead zombie, the one that starts us off, the one that kind of becomes the face of zombies for this movie. Doesn't he look a bit like Boris Karloff?
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think, Chris? Are you familiar with the Frankenstein movies?
Yeah, I'm with the first two. I was bringing up something on IMDb. They did base it off Boris Karloff, according to the trivia, but it was okay. They said they can't remember the name of it, but it was based on a Karloff movie called The Walking Dead, where Karloff played a man risen from the dead and walks with a characteristic ungainly saunter. So
I'm not surprised at all. Yeah. Not surprised.
So that's pretty much spot on. So yeah,
rock on. Yeah, but all right. So let's go ahead and let's talk about the movie itself, because I have to admit, this is a movie that's 96 minutes,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I'm not correct.
Yeah.
This is a very, I don't want to say it's a very short movie. I mean, there's other movies that are shorter, but I have to admit that this moves really quickly. I mean, it doesn't take time. It kind of develops one scene after another, after another, after another. There's an urgency that this movie has, and especially considering the certain periods of the, certain segments of the film where a lot of things are kind of having to happen at the same time, right? It's having to do a lot of character exposition. It's having to establish geography. Practically every scene is setting up geography of the house, of the surrounding area, of kind of characters' relationships with one another, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the film itself, right from the beginning, we're given two characters, Johnny and Barbara, right? This is a brother and sister who are coming out here to, not because they want to, right? They're there for their mother, who,
right,
to take a new headstone, or I guess
it's
just a cross wreath.
Wreath thing, yeah.
That didn't look like a wreath, though. It kind of looks like a headstone, or it's a cross.
I
know that much, but
it's basically a name. It's just a tomb name, a grave name.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
But one thing I found very interesting about this particular sequence is how much exposition is tossed within like about 4 minutes.
Yeah.
The first 4 minutes, I mean, right off the bat, we establish Johnny and Barbara are siblings. We get a bit about their history, about their relationship with one another. We get that Barbara is kind of uptight and she doesn't really want to be there. Johnny is kind of the goofball. He's the one that's more protective of the two. I love how we're introduced to our main zombie and we don't even realize it right off the bat.
Yeah.
You know, I especially love it when the threat is kind of off in the periphery. It's, you know, it's not focused on. It's, you don't even realize what it is that you're seeing until it just, you know, that it kind of comes at you. And in this particular case, the first time we see the zombie, we just think it's just some guy walking in a graveyard, right?
Right.
You know, even the characters kind of just, you know, kind of joke about it.
Well,
or Johnny does specifically.
I kind of suspect because, you know, it's a zombie, we want to get to the zombies quick.
Yeah,
they don't know.
Well, I mean, the movie doesn't really give us an indication. Like, there's no musical cues, right? The first time we see it, there's no music that plays that there's threat or that there's danger nearby. It's, you know, we're so enthralled with what Johnny and Barbara are talking about in their conversation and just the human dynamics. If there were no zombies, I think I'd be just as interested as what that conversation was going to be, you know, even if nothing happened, they got back in the car and just bickered all the way back to Pittsburgh, right? The chemistry together is really interesting, especially Johnny, and I'll be honest here. The kid who plays Johnny, I would have loved it if he would have stuck around for more of the movie, because this guy's just naturally charismatic, right?
Yep.
Pretty much, yeah.
I mean, and especially since he dies in the fight with the zombie, I especially love that. I especially love that because we have that chemistry and we understand why she's distraught. We understand why she is upset by what happened to her brother, and that helps us a little bit. Now we'll talk about Barbara more in depth in just a little bit, but Yeah, I mean, what do you take of this relationship? Do you find yourself kind of... What do you feel about these two characters before we get into the whole zombie invasion?
Barbara fucking sucks. That's my that's my takeaway from it. Yeah. Did you guys ever see the remake of this from the 90s that Tom Savini did?
No,
I haven't.
But they almost, from what I read, they almost made Barbara like the hero and like a total badass. They totally do that in the remake, right? So she's like this. She's basically Rambo with fucking zombies and shit. But like here, she's just. Well, you have mixed emotions with the remake. I'll give you that. That's all I'll say on that.
We'll talk. Yeah. We'll talk about Barbara. I don't think Barbara was ever intended to be the main protagonist.
Oh.
Yeah.
Which is odd, since she's the first one we meet, but it's...
Oh, no. I think it's a psych out. I think it's a fake out. And I think Romero did this intentionally, because especially with horror movies of this period. In fact, I want to say horror movies all the way up to the 30s, we always have the final girl, right? The female protagonist. We constantly, it's something that is always, that is kind of a trope in itself, even after Night of the Living Dead. I mean, hell, the whole term "final girl" was really kind of coined throughout the 70s from Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which we'll talk about in a few weeks, through Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th. It's a trope at this particular point, right? Mm-hmm. And I think Romero is wanting to take that on his head because our main protagonist is a black man.
Right.
I mean, that's, you know, in a way, I think, especially considering that even after Night of the Living Dead, I mean, what's the trope when it comes to the black character?
First one to die, usually.
First to die, yeah.
Usually, yeah.
Yeah. And so I think what Romero is doing is he's taking this particular trope and he's twisting it on its head. He's setting us up kind of in the same way as Psycho. And I think that in a way that Romero is doing his own kind of rendition of Psycho, because when we meet Ben right off the bat, he is capable, he's confident, he takes command quickly, and he immediately becomes the hero, the protagonist, the hero that we're wanting in this type of situation, right? He's decisive. He stays on top of everything. He commands the situation, right?
He punches hysterical bitches in the face. He's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't put it... Well, that's putting a little bit more bluntly than I would have said, but...
Okay, tells uppity middle-class white guys that, hey, what you're doing is dumb.
well, we'll get into that.
Yeah.
We'll get into that because... one of the things that I think also I especially like about this movie is characters act naturally, right? No one does things that seems completely off, you know, completely off. Like, no one makes the whole idea of, like, running up the stairs knowing that you're going to get trapped, right? Everyone, even with Barbara, look at how she deals with that first zombie. Right? I mean, she sees the zombie killer brother. She runs. She trips. What does she do? She takes her fucking shoes off.
Yeah.
This isn't Jurassic World, I mean, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, she gets in the car. She, she pops the
parking brake.
Yeah.
You know, she does. I mean, yeah. I mean, she's scared, and this thing is coming at her. And then the fear that she's having is natural. We understand why she doesn't just immediately pop the brake, because she's scared. But when she gets her head on for the few seconds that she does before she loses it completely, she does what we would expect anyone would do in this type of situation, right? No one's acting either too stupidly or too like the screenplay is directing them to do something that they wouldn't normally do, right? I mean, especially when we get to Harry and Ben. I mean, Harry is right when he says that the barricades that were put together aren't going to last. He's right about it. But at the same time, what Ben does would be what anyone would do, right? Like, if we were in that situation, we would have done practically the same thing, or we would hope to think that we would do the same thing that Ben did, right?
Right.
I mean, if he had built perfect barricades, then that would have felt completely unnatural.
Well, he did the best with what he had, too. So
Yeah.
And so these are especially the initial takeaways that I would get with how the characters act in this particular movie, and how they would act with one another. In fact, I would almost want to say that, if I'm not correct, that the film was shot basically in chronological order, so that the characters can naturally build to what they were doing.
Except, right? except the cemetery scene, that was shot last.
Well, that's perfectly understandable. Yeah. But everything inside the house. And I have to admit, when Barbara gets to the house, I especially love how Romero uses her to set the geography of the house. We see all the major aspects. We see the downstairs. We see the upstairs. We see that door to the basement, which will become important in just a little bit. All of this is done before Ben shows up, before the zombies basically are at the door, right?
Right.
You know where everything is. The scene is set during this particular walk through the house. Is that what y'all are getting away from this, or did y'all find yourselves confused as to where everything was?
It's establishing, and it also tells you why she's not going to hide upstairs, because she's scared of the bodies.
Well, okay, so let's talk about that body for a second, because I thought it was hilarious that... So we had zombies that were in the house.
Yeah.
And they ate the person that was upstairs. They ate the skin, but they left the eyeball? Like, that was, I mean, considering that, especially since we see them eat later on in the film, why did they leave a perfectly good eyeball?
Why didn't that corpse change? Why didn't it become a zombie?
That was
my
question,
too. I don't think it had anything. It has to have muscle to be able to move, and I think they stripped it because it was down to the bone, wasn't it?
I thought it was just the face that was missing stuff. Well, when they pull...
Well, we don't see much.
When Ben pulls the body later, it's just, you know, it's somebody else. They have a face, but, you know.
And on top of that, if you'll notice, and this is something I've also found interesting, one of the reasons why I think that this was more based on Frankenstein than it was on our normal rendition of a zombie, is because if you look at the zombies that we have in this movie, we don't see bite marks. We don't see pieces torn off of them. They all look relatively unmolested.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, because, especially like when we get into, and I think part of that is because of the budget that the film had. It didn't have the budget to do the bite marks and to do all of the gore. You know, because if I'm not correct, with the exception of the feeding frenzy that we have late in the film, we don't get a whole lot of gore in the film, right?
Little trickles of blood, and that's about it,
yeah.
Well, I mean, we have the body upstairs, and then, you know, we have a couple of times when we see Ben basically kick Sirius' ass.
Yeah.
But, you know, with that exception, I mean, even then, we don't see a whole lot of, like, head smashing. It looks like, you know, that they use, like, one dummy and just kind of reuse that dummy from time to time.
Oh, the hand that reaches in through the window. That was kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah, there's that.
For what you would think of as a zombie movie, this is relatively clean.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
I mean, this is very clean. I think some of it's the budget. They just kind of... There's a lot more implication and theater of the mind going on than actually just showing you. So, which means it was easier for you to stomach. I get scared easily.
And I think you were about to say something that I also am going to agree completely on, that the other reason why it was as clean as it was, if you want to go ahead and finish up, because I have a feeling that...
I was going to say budget, but...
Say something else.
He was going for a PG rating.
It is 1968.
That's true. Yeah. Well, I,
you know,
actually, this movie was not rated.
Yeah, this was the last movie released without a rating, according to IMDb. Yeah.
No.
I think that's what I said. Let me double check. I'll double check it.
Well, no, there are a lot of, even today, there are movies that are released unrated, but the thing is, though, is that the Hays Code was at its dying throes.
Yeah.
At this particular point, you know, well, this Good is point. 8 years after Psycho. This, you know, movies of this particular nature are about to get made heavy. I mean, we're
Grindhouse
about to get into
the
age of...
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, remember what Grindhouse really is. Grindhouse are extremely low-budget films made by extremely independent filmmakers with the technology and the prosthetics that are possible at this particular point. You just mentioned Tom Savini. Well, Tom Savini was the right-hand man of one George A. Romero. In fact, he single-handedly made Dawn of the Dead. the way it was. And, you know, from there, he would go on to be the badass that would basically rule horror all the way up until the 2000s. Right.
Savini's awesome.
You know,
man.
We talked about him specifically with Friday the 13th. Mm. You know, Savini. I mean, George. Sorry, not George. Greg Nicotero.
Right.
You know, the guy who's basically the
showrunner,
one responsible for The Walking Dead right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was a protege of Savini, and you can definitely tell his influence from that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Oh, totally.
But what are y'all taking from these particular types of zombies? What, and kind of how they play in this particular film? Do you sense them to be that they are more than just an immediate threat to the characters? And I'm mentioning this specifically because, as we would see with like Dawn of the Dead, Romero has a tendency of giving them an added meaning. You know, that he's trying to say something more about zombies than just that they're a threat. But do you see that with Night of the Living Dead, or are they just basically there to munch them?
I always felt like he always had the zombies, like, adapt in a certain way in all of his movies. Like, they started, like, communicating in land. And here, by the end of the film, they smash headlights with rocks. They throw rocks through windows and shit. And then by the end of the movie, they're, like, actually picking up the bits of the wood that had like the fire on it and stuff when they're originally afraid of it early on. Mm-hmm. So I mean, it's cool to see them like kind of
they adapt.
Yeah, I mean that's cool because they show like progress.
They're adaptive tool users, which is really scary. But there's an interesting zombie trope that starts here, of course, is that the zombies are an issue. Definitely, they're going out killing people and eating them. But the real issue tends to be the survivors group together that don't know each other and start bickering almost right away about how to deal with the zombies.
Actually, that's a really interesting transition point that you brought up here, which is at what point, what are the biggest threats in this movie? Is it the zombies or the other humans? Because especially considering that our main protagonist is Ben and the only African American in the cast, you sense that he's not just dealing with the zombies. He's having to deal especially with Harry, you know, who
right.
Harry's bitch ass. God. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah. Sorry.
All right, which
You mean the black guy has to deal with the white middle-aged middle American guy who thinks he's right about everything? No. Now the other white guy, it tends to listen to both sides and go, you know, Ben is kind of making sense here.
Here's a question that I have for you, and I wonder what y'all think about this. Could it be that the zombies, in a way, is George A. Romero kind of trying to talk about civil rights in a little bit? Not that the zombies are African Americans, but the zombies are kind of the change to the system. The fact that they don't care who they're eating, as you know, because you know, white meat, dark meat don't matter to them. Right.
Yeah.
This is kind of, in a way, an equalizer, kind of making everyone equal.
I don't know. I feel like it's kind of like an accidental coincidence.
Kind of an accidental coincidence?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, look at what all of the characters call the zombies. They call them monsters. They call them
ghouls.
Creeps.
Ghouls. They never call them zombies.
Right. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, they dehumanize
mm-hmm.
these creatures, right? These zombies.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
They turn them into something lesser, right? Something that we see specifically in civil rights with what people were doing with African American, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even though I've heard that argument, but okay.
Well, I mean, we'll talk about the ending of the movie because I think that's another reason why I'm kind of curious to see if you might think that this is the situation. But so let's talk about our human characters, because these are the characters that we're really with for the most part, right? We have Ben, who is our main protagonist. We have Barbara, who is I kind of see her as the fake out. I think it's interesting that they basically make her completely useless for the rest of the film.
Yeah.
Once she finds Ben, that she's kind of the character that we are seeing through the eyes, because when she passes out, we pass out, and then when we wake up, all of a sudden, holy crap, we have all these new characters. Where do these people come from? As it turns out, they were actually there the entire time because they were in the basement, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we have Harry. We have Helen, his wife, who they have a small child that's downstairs. Then we have a young couple, Tom and Judy, right?
Judy, yeah.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, they're young. They're impressionable. They're kind of the hip youngsters, right? Because, you know, Tom works with Ben. You know, he doesn't even think twice about it, right? There's no questioning. There's no, we need to work together, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's Harry, who's of an older generation, who doesn't trust Ben at all. He doesn't come out and show racial hatred towards him, but that mistrust is definitely there. And he treats Ben differently than he does even Tom, right? Because he's friendly to Tom, or not friendly, but he is kind of willing to work with Tom, where he is just not willing to work with Ben, right?
Yeah.
So, again, I just kind of, so, but what do we think about these other characters? And I understand, Chris, where you're coming from with Harry.
Okay, so, like, Tom is totally cool until he goes to pump the fucking gas. What is he doing? The fuck is he doing?
He's young and dumb.
What is he doing, man? Come on.
He doesn't know how to operate a gas pump at a farm.
He lives
slightly different.
Yeah, there's a difference between handling a gas pump when it's just you and the pump. It's a different thing when you have like 1,000 zombies that are coming up on you.
Yeah, that too.
He just starts squirting it everywhere, though. Like, it's a... man.
Well, he doesn't go full Zoolander.
Well, then he just... But then he, like, jumps in the car when it's on fire. Man, come on. You deserve to die. Come on.
Well, I think he just didn't want to leave Judy because she gets stuck, right? I mean, he's not going to abandon her.
He should have.
Come on.
Judy was dumb to get out there to begin with. He told her to stay there, and then she's like,
yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, he did. He definitely did.
Probably didn't want to stay there with Harry's monkey ass because, you know.
Yeah.
maybe that's why Judy decided to take her chances with the zombies.
Yeah, I'd probably take, like, catching on fire in a car than hanging out with Harry any day as well. So.
Yeah.
But
I think it's also kind of a bullshit how Harry locks Ben out of the house.
Oh, it's total dick move. Total dick move.
Yeah. But no, it's completely a dick move.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so when he does that, I mean, at this particular point, we're hoping Harry's going to be zombie chowder, right?
And in a way,
like at this particular point, we're just waiting for him to get inhaled.
At this point, do we know his daughter was bitten?
When she's laying down, you can see the bandage, and there's, like, blood seeping through the bandage. That's about it.
Well, the thing is that, and then this is one of the places where I actually applaud the fact that the film does have a very low budget quality, so that you're really not fully aware of what really is going on, because the film stock just isn't... it doesn't have that full HD quality to it.
Right.
Now, bear in mind that I did see the 2K restoration that was done, I think, about 2 years ago. But
was that with the deleted scenes that they just found recently or whatever?
No. That's a 4K restoration that's being released, I think, next week.
Really?
Ooh. But I wouldn't mind seeing that specifically. But again, we'll hold off on that because we have a little bit more to talk about in this one. But I love the fact that, you know, they just say that she's sick, that she's not feeling good. Of course, because we're all very familiar with zombie movies, I think all of us know that, you know, she's probably going to be a zombie. But for an audience that hasn't seen a zombie movie before, that isn't familiar with the zombie tropes, I can definitely see them thinking, okay, well, she's just sick, and that they don't realize that she is going to turn. And then when she kills her mother, God, that is so...
That is weird, because she commits murder rather than, and uses a tool to do it, rather than just eating her.
Well, but yeah. The thing is that they haven't established. I mean, they established that they're eating them, but the first zombie that we see was using rocks to break windows.
Yeah,
we've seen them use weapons before.
Right. Yeah. It's
so
just interesting.
Not completely outside.
No, granted, a trowel would not be my first choice. There's got to be a hammer nearby or something. But
well, I'm thinking that it's the closest weapon that she could find. It isn't like a zombie's going to go out and go, huh, what's the best weapon to use? What's the best weapon? You know what? I'll use this hammer. No, it's like, oh, pointy thing, use it. I mean, they're still primal in that sense.
Now, right. She does end up eating her dad's arm.
So, what I read was, according to the IMDb thing again, they originally contemplated Harry eating the daughter, and I guess they thought it was too controversial for the time or whatever.
I'll tell you right now, if Harry had eaten his daughter, it would have become a national outrage at that particular point. I mean, it's already bad enough that you have a daughter, you know, killing mother and, you know, eating her father.
Yeah.
If it were the other way around, especially being a child, we have never seen another zombie movie until like 90s at that particular point. Mm. You know, they might have actually reinvigorated the whole MPAA or the whole Hays Code thing for another 30 years if that were happening.
Side note, if you want to have a good laugh, look up the IMDb character of the daughter. And her biography, it's fine. Just, okay, listeners, go to IMDb, read it real quick, and have a chuckle. It's for Karen Cooper.
But what do we think about these arguments that these characters are having, especially, you know, in the second act of the film? Because to me, I think it's very interesting. Here they are. They have a serious threat outside, yet they're more worried about each other than they are about the threat that's outside that's literally out to kill them.
We know about the hordes outside trying to kill us, but let's just mistrust each other because I could understand Harry to a certain extent because he's defending his child. But at the same time, the arguments about most defensive position in the house.
Okay, so the biggest argument here is that Harry wants to basically lay claim to the basement, and that Ben wants to protect the entire house. Now, technically speaking, where do you lie on this argument? Do you think that they should have protected the entire house, or do you think that they should have held up in the basement?
Nobody went upstairs. After that one scene where he drags that girl down the hallway, they never go upstairs.
Well, you go upstairs, you're basically cordoning yourself off, and on top of that, you have only zombies underneath you.
Yeah, but you also have more room than you did down in the basement. See? And then you got windows.
Yeah, but we don't have awnings, if I'm not correct. There wasn't exactly any awnings that they could, like, climb out of and stay above the zombies. I could be wrong on that, but I
don't think so either. But, I mean, I don't know. Considering I'm, like, I'm not, like...
And we've seen that the zombies can climb. We see that they aren't exactly, they're not exactly dogs, you know, they'll basically just bark out, you know, circle around. If they find a chance to get in, if they have the chance to latch onto something, they can climb, they can do practically anything that a human can, you know, they're, so, I don't know, I find that to be, I don't know, I think that it's a more difficult place to defend from upstairs than it would be from downstairs, because you can reinforce the doors, you can, in fact, as we see, Ben survives the night because of the freaking, basement.
Yeah.
Well, my vote is you seal up the first floor like he was, and then you retreat to the basement, and you just seal that door, as long as there's no windows down there.
Well, I think that we should say that basically what they should have done was Helm's Deep that motherfucker, right? Oh, I mean, seriously, I mean, everyone here has seen The Lord of the Rings. We've seen how they defended Helm's Deep. You defend the outside perimeter. If it gets breached, you go to the inside perimeter. You know, and you reinforce that, and that way you hold them off for as long as you can, right?
You just keep withdrawing as they get through, but there are a lot of windows in there.
There are, yeah.
There were, yeah. But you could seal off the other parts of the house, too, just deal with that, because,
But also I find it very interesting here is kind of how technology works in this particular film, specifically the radio and the television, because we get most of our exposition comes from the radio or the television, right? Which is a staple of Romero. He loves using these things to kind of deliver the exposition. What I find very interesting about how this film uses it is that we kind of see how the zombie outbreak affects larger areas. It seems like they're handling it pretty well inside the cities. And I think that part of the reason why they're having a big problem is that they're out in the country and they're isolated. They don't have police forces nearby that can take care of this. In fact, they have to wait for the cops and for the National Guard to come and help kill them off, right?
Yeah, well, the big cities have their own police, have the bigger police forces. They have probably more, even on the countryside, you'd expect more private citizens with guns, which they form the later posses that go on, so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the cities themselves, it seems like they pretty much have things in control. I mean, they have the television stations are still up, and they seem to be very confident in keeping everything under control. You know, yeah, they have the warnings and alerts, and they are in a serious situation, but they're definitely in more control than out in the country, right? Yeah. And I think it's also interesting considering that last week, I had discussed Attack the Block, where in that particular situation, London had an alien invasion problem that it seemed like the police forces could handle. It was a nuisance. Yeah. It wasn't a dire emergency threat where they have to worry about about all human life and existence being threatened by this alien invasion. And in a way, I kind of got that sense here. It's like, especially considering that they're saying that this had something to do with the radiation that had been spilled over a Venus probe, kind of using that as kind of as to what happened. It seems to me that this is a situation that once they deal with the immediate threat, that's it. Once they can contain the situation as it is right now, this isn't going to be a threat that's going to be ongoing. Once they deal with it, it'll be done. Is that kind of how you're seeing it? Or do you see that this is kind of something that is going to turn into what we get with, like, Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead and the other Romero Dead movies?
I mean, I think that's the intention, but, like, the way his movies play out, they don't, like you mentioned earlier, they're not necessarily sequels, but, like, they never end well, and they always get worse. Everything always gets worse, and
So you think that the Dawn and Day scenario was inevitable in this particular universe? That had Romero not made those movies, that we would have seen this situation keep getting worse?
If Romero hadn't made it, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
After the end of the movie, I'm not sure.
I mean, because let's be honest here. I mean, the cops do clean up the zombie horde pretty quickly. As soon as they come in, they're just killing them like right and left. You know.
Yeah.
That's something that's very interesting, and I love the fact that the film we step away from the house, we see the cops, they're just cleaning up left and right, and we're given the impression that Ben is going to be okay.
Yeah.
But we forget that this is 1968. So, of course, as soon as he steps out, bam.
He doesn't even really step out. He's still inside in the window, kind of looking out, going, hey, what's going on here? Bam.
Yeah, all they see is movement.
I mean, and they do not confirm what is inside the building before they shoot.
Here's the question. Had Ben been white, would this have ended same way?
Yes, it would have ended the same way.
That's the controversy, but also I think all Ben would have had to do was yell from the window, but he was still trying to figure out, hey, are those cops or more zombies? Oh, well, they're cops. Bang. He's dead before he could process, so he can yell, hey, survivor.
So basically this police force has Chris Kyle on their sniper team.
Yeah.
Because let's be honest here, that's a pretty far distant shot. That's not some, you know, not something that just anybody can do on a single one shot kill, right? That's like SWAT team precision, right? Because I want to say that that's what, maybe like 150 yards? Because they're off in the distance, not like,
yeah.
You know, they're like
that's,
50 yards.
That's... It's a long shot through a window where you really can't see the target very well.
And a headshot.
Right.
Okay. That's not, I mean, say what you will, but at that particular distance, a headshot in a dark window. Because the whole point was is that they couldn't tell if Ben was alive or dead, or, you know, or a zombie.
Mm-hmm.
And so they basically just shot first, asked questions later, considering that, you know, the fact that they're killing these zombies, that they're supposedly there to, you know, protect people who've survived. Right? They didn't give any warning. They didn't put out like a megaphone. Considering that they have the forces, they could have just basically put out a megaphone and have the zombies come to them, which would be better for them because then they would know where the zombies are coming from. Right? You know, because if you set up like a sound where they would definitely be coming, because I'm assuming that they respond to sound. Right?
So
one of the reasons why the zombies came out in mass to that house was the fact that they had a whole bunch of people talking, shouting, screaming. And playing radios and television.
Right, yeah. Radio and TV's on, really loud. I wonder if the zombies were attracted to that. Yeah.
So why didn't, like, nailing the boards up and all that commotion, like, bring more zombies?
But it did.
It did. I mean, we see it them. Did.
Yeah, it was only, like, a handful, though, but then, like...
Well, it's isolated. It isn't inside a city, so they had to walk there.
Well, yeah, but like when the crowd starts coming, that one shirtless zombie is like walking towards that house the entire fucking movie.
Are you talking about naked zombie?
No, there's a shirtless one off in like it's on the right side of the horde.
Oh,
he's only wearing pants.
Yes,
he's only wearing pants. Yeah,
I saw him.
Yeah, he shows up inside later.
What about naked zombie? That was like, well, I wasn't expecting a moon out tonight.
You kind of wonder what the story is behind every individual one. Because if they didn't do makeup to make them look like they'd been torn in two, if they were all dead, then what the heck happened?
Taking a shower. And something happened.
Swept and fell. Okay, next.
Broke their neck.
Yeah.
But... All right, so, but what do we think about Ben's fate, especially considering that and one of the things I have to admit I really love about Romero films is that the film keeps going even as the credits roll, because we see what happens to Ben's body, we see what happens to the fate of the other zombies that they kill, right? And we kind of get a semi-epilogue as we get the final credits, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what do you take of this? Did Ben's death have an impact on you? The fact that he was basically burned along with the zombies that he had been fighting off? What did y'all take of this?
It felt like a lynching, just those first scenes of when you see
him. Considering that it was also white actors, white police officers that kill him?
Yeah.
But maybe does this kind of make you think that maybe there is kind of a civil rights aspect to this movie, maybe just a little bit?
A little to the ending, but then again, they are just doing a lot. I'm not sure why they're using the hooks for the cleanup, but... Oh.
Dramatic effect.
Yeah.
But, alright, so at this particular point, was there anything else that you wanted to bring up in regards to the film? Any aspects that you found very interesting? Any scenes that you wanted to talk about?
Oh, so Ben's death, like, it sucked for Ben. I liked Ben. He was awesome. But, like, I love the ending. I think it's great. Like, I feel like it's like the ending to The Mist. Pissed a lot of people off. Love that one, too. So...
I hate the ending to The Mist. I hate the ending to The Mist. It completely destroys the whole premise. But that's a whole different conversation for a whole different time. Oh, God. You just triggered me big time. Oh, man.
You had to ask. You had to ask. There you go.
We're talking about that. All right. But I actually love this ending, although it does make me mad. But at the same time, though, it just fits. It fits because, you know, the whole idea of this is that humanity, even with humanity doing the best it can, people die. And Ben, the fact that Ben gets killed by by humans, it wasn't the zombies that kill him, it's humans who, I'm assuming, I'm going to be very I'm going to assume that, and give benefit of doubt, that they didn't realize that he was, living, and just shot him because of the skin color of his skin, but, it was just a mistake.
Well, they never mention his skin color either. They're just kind of like, they see the movement. He says something about, I forget the exact words.
But they just assume that he's a zombie.
Yeah.
I think that's the kind of the point. I think that's the point that the film is saying, is that they already assumed that the worst of him.
Right.
Which is, again, something you could say about civil rights, is that that they just assume that he's a villain because he's black.
Well, to fuel the argument even further, you know what happened a few days, or like near the film's release, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Martin Luther King's death or whatever. And yeah. So, yeah.
Although that's a coincidence, but definitely
right.
I think it does impact impact kind of how the film goes about in this particular discussion. But
was it received well theatrically at the time? Because I've read about like how it was afterwards,
It was shocking. I think that's the one word that could describe how this film came out, because no one has seen violence like this in a movie up to this particular point. Now, as we get into the 70s, this would become a mainstay, and this would inspire guys like Tobe Hooper to make their own renditions of this type of movie, and even more daring, even more disgusting. And on top of that, you also have to understand that at this particular point, the Italians have gotten their hands into this kind of filmmaking as well.
spaghetti Western, spaghetti intestinal tract eating.
Well, it was called the Giallo films.
Giallo,
became really big. We'd have guys like Dario Argento and Fulci. Lucio Fulci making their own kind of movies. And at some point, I have a feeling we will talk about something like Suspiria. I know that next year we have a remake coming out, so we might have to do Suspiria for next year. But, but the Italians were making things that, we had, in fact, there was a Night of the Living Dead knockoff in Italy called Zombie, of all things.
I thought that was that's a Dawn knockoff.
Oh, yeah, that's right, that's Dawn.
Because that was Zombie in Europe,
But, this kind of movie was, was about to be made international. But again, leave it up to the Americans to kind of be the first ones out to do this. And, basically just a bunch of kids in Pennsylvania just decided to change the rules when it comes to movies. And now I would honestly say, in my opinion, that the modern day horror film starts with Night of the Living Dead. I will go so far as to say that. There have been other horror films prior to this that have kind of been in this direction, but the relation to violence and horror hasn't been done like this until this particular movie. Mm-hmm. But that's just kind of how I get it. But what about y'all? Do y'all see this as being the forefather of modern horror, or do you see another film being that, or where do you see this as being in the scope of horror as we now know it?
It did munch the zombie subgenre. The question is for horror, because horror really starts branching in the 70s, so we got all sorts of real slasher and blood spray stuff
going. In a couple of weeks, we will be talking about the movie that was considered to be the most influential horror film that created the other major horror genre, the slasher. We'll be talking about that film in a couple of weeks. But movie came out years before that movie.
But do have, it's like creating, it's like you can't point at horror and say it's one genre almost when you've got zombie, which is, as I pointed out earlier, is as much the survivors bickering and arguing among themselves as it is zombies outside. So, which, I don't know if that's more story-ish trope, or if that is the genre, or how all stories merge into one eventually.
Actually, I have another question right quick now that I'm thinking about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
When it comes to the actual horror element of this film, the zombies and how the zombies attack, where do you think the suspense and the horror comes from? Is it the presence of the zombie? Is it how they attack? Is it the fact that they look like normal human beings that are just basically attacking? What aspects do you find to be the suspense or the horror of this film?
I think... because this was the first zombie movie, yes?
Yes.
Well,
so
yeah.
There was like an unpredictability factor to it as well. So it was like, you didn't know what they were going to do. Yeah, they're like crazed and how do they word it in the movie? You know, just maniacal and just... so...
What about you, Ken?
Oh.
Yeah.
Repeat the question exactly. So,
where do you see the horror or the suspense coming from zombies?
The fact that they want to eat you. And they can't be negotiated. They can't be reasonable.
They're not eating brains yet either. That's interesting.
No, they're just regular meat eaters.
Yeah.
Well, no, it's actually Return of the Living Dead that turned the brains aspect. It wasn't even Romero. It was actually his partner.
Yeah.
You know, the guy who owned the Living Dead name.
Which doesn't make quite as much sense, really, when you get into the dead have risen and they're hungry and they're just going for heart. So.
Oh, come on. If you haven't seen Return of the Living Dead, you don't know what awesomeness is in regards to brains.
I have heard of it, so. I've heard people do nothing but talk it, so. It's like, whatever, okay, so.
Oh, we need to schedule a screening for you, Ken.
No, you don't.
Yeah, no. That movie is awesome.
It's not that great.
It is fun, it's funny, it's goofy, it is punk. It is pure awesome.
You can turn it off after Tar Man, so yeah.
Okay.
You're so wrong. So wrong. All right. Anything else we want to talk about with this movie before we call it a night?
Let's see. Forever coming back.
We got any geek sheet here, with the exception of Romero himself.
Yeah.
Geek sheet.
Really, not a mark on the brother for being killed and then back to take his sister to introduce his sister to all these people who want to take her out to dinner. Wait,
take her out for dinner.
Yes.
I love the fact that he was the one that says, they're coming to get you, Barbara.
Yeah.
And it's, I'm coming to get you, Barbara.
Yeah.
Although it would have been awesome if he would have been able to talk like that. That would have been a great callback. But damn, I actually love this guy, Johnny. The guy who played Johnny, why did this guy not do anything big after that? Because he was so much fun. I could easily see him doing other stuff. He's just got a lot of charisma.
Well, they were all probably just students, and they were
most of these people were paid in beer. I mean,
yeah, friends of Romero. It's the Kevin Smith School of Filmmaking. Hey, my friends are just going to be in a movie, and we're not interested. We got lives. I'm insurance sales now, so okay. So,
I mean, there was another George Miller, who basically did the same thing with a little movie called Mad Max.
Yeah.
I mean, he paid practically all of the cast and crew in beer. So, just saying. I mean, that's 70s style filmmaking before unions get involved.
Well,
I said it, Lobster, come at me.
The guy that was Harry did a bunch of other shit for the movie. I don't know if you guys knew that.
Oh, actually, I think everyone in the cast and crew had like multiple parts. I mean, this is a very small production.
Oh, okay.
Like I said, about 20,000 to 30,000 to make this movie.
Most of the posse was also zombies. So.
Yeah. But yeah, this is, everyone was doing double duty. But that's something that would actually be kind of a point of pride when it comes to these small independent features.
Yeah.
You know, hell, I was watching I want to say it was a retrospective on Friday the 13th, where they were talking like, hey, when you're not doing, you know, when you weren't doing something on film, when one of your shooting days, you were doing grip work or you're doing running errands, you're being a PA or an aide for somebody. You know, everyone had an investment in doing the best that they could. And that was kind of the beauty of these kind of low-budget horror films. And it's one of the reasons why horror directors go on to be bigger, do bigger things, because you have to be imaginative on these very low budgets. Horror films, the best horror films, are always under budget. So that when you actually have a larger budget, you take that very, you don't waste that. You try to get as much out of it as humanly possible. All the same now. I guess it's time that we can go ahead and call it. Does anyone have anything else to say before we do?
I was going to say brains, but no, wrong. That hasn't happened.
All right, let's call it then. Chris, Kent, do you agree with the critics on Night of the Living Dead? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Kent?
I'm going to say they got me, because this really is a very, very key movie for the whole history of modern horror. Basically begins when this movie comes out, I'll just say that. So I'm giving it pass, and I'm pleasantly surprised by how I treat it. So I would say go with the original black and white prints. Apparently there's been attempts to colorize it. Avoid it.
No.
I would say avoid the colorizing.
No.
I think this movie works best and it's just original black and white, especially with some bad body part pop going on. But yeah. So and yeah. So
right, Chris.
It's a pass for me too. I mean, it's the first Romero movie, first zombie movie. The ending alone stands, you know, the test of time. And, yeah, I mean, it's just like a classic basically for horror movies. So definite pass for me.
I absolutely adore this movie. I think it's brilliant. I think it's hard hitting. I think that it's a testament that out of the billions of zombie movies, I can still watch this 10, 15 times and not get bored with it just off of the acting alone. Especially the main actors. All of them do a really good job. They make me feel for the characters. Even if I don't like them, I understand why they are the way they are. And I do think that Romero is kind of talking about civil rights with his zombie movie in this one. Obviously, with later films, he'll be talking about consumerism with the zombies. He'll be talking about complacency and warmongering. He'll use his zombies to convey different emotions, but I definitely get a civil rights vibe off of this at this particular point. I love the acting, the direction. I love the low budget feel for it and how he was able to get so much out of so little. Obviously, when it comes to the zombies themselves, they don't, you know, they feel more like Frankenstein than they do about the contemporary zombie movie. But, and I think that with later zombie movies, that especially after Tom Savini changed the game with this trope, I think that other filmmakers who do zombie movies get a little complacent. You know, they put too much on the shock, and they don't allow the zombies to kind of have the personality that they do here. And to me, that's kind of a sad thing. But overall, though, this is an absolutely amazing film. And if I may say so, because I know for a fact, this is a great zombie movie to start your little ones on if you're wanting to scare the living shit out of them. So, just saying. I would say that this is, I know it's unrated, but I would say, you know, if you have a teenager, about 14 or about 13 or 14 years old, this is, you know, yeah, with the exception of the whole eating, you know, the feeding frenzy scene late in the film. Yeah, this is, I would probably put this at a PG-13 if it weren't for the feeding frenzy scene. But if you're confident with your kid, yeah, they could handle it. This is a definitely a good scary movie to start them off with. But, you know, that's just my take on it. But yeah, absolute pass. So I think it's time that we step away from the zombies and we take on a more brighter, more colorful creature. What do you say, Kent?
I think I'm going to hide underneath a blanket and not come out until these guys that want me dead are just funny just go back to their spaceships.
Oh, come on. You know, the colorful pom-poms and the deadly ice cream and cotton candy are going to be absolutely a blast for our House of Horror. And if I may say so, I think it's about time that we handle the cult classic awesomeness that is Killer Clowns from Outer Space. And I think we have a few people joining us for that episode, and I can't wait to have this conversation. What about y'all?
Never seen it, so yeah.
All right. But Art House of Horror is just getting a start. Kent, do you want to give us a rundown of what else we've got coming up this terrifying month?
Well, Killer Clowns. We're going down to Texas for some, learn how to make chili, the chainsaw method, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and wrap up with, good old recent indie film, called Green Room.
Yeah. And I can't wait to talk about both of those movies with you as well. And of course, if you have anything that you want to say about the film that we discussed or any of the other films that we discussed, you can always hit us up on Facebook, on our Facebook page. You can also send us a tweet at Arthouse Legends, or if you just want to email us, arthouselegends@gmail.com. I will respond to any that you send to us. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me through this episode. Any last words?
Barbara and Harry eat zombie dick. That's it. There you go.
Well, that, I can't say anything else. This is the Movie Dude Eric.
This is Kent.
And this is Chris.
And Brains.
Please leave us a positive review on iTunes.
Music by Kevin MacLeod.
Legends Podcast is not affiliated with any other entity. The opinions stated in this podcast are strictly personal and do not represent the view of its sponsor or any other person or entity. No infringement is intended.